I carefully eased myself onto a kitchen chair and took my first fry. "Ah," I said. Morelli was slouched in the chair opposite me, finishing his coffee.
"Feeling better?"
I sipped some Coke, and I ate more fries.
"Much better."
"Are you ready for ketchup?"
"Definitely."
Morelli got the ketchup out of the fridge and dumped some on a plate for me. I mushed some fries in the ketchup and tested them out.
"I think the brain swelling is going down," I said to Morelli. "The pounding has stopped."
"Always a good sign," Morelli said.
He rinsed his cup and set it in the dish drain.
"I'm out of here. I have to get the computer to the lab."
He kissed me on the top of my head.
"Be careful. Tank's outside doing his thing. Try not to lose him."
"I owe you," I said.
"Yeah, I know. I already have plans."
And he was gone. Bob was patiently sitting beside me, waiting for his share. I fed him a couple fries, finished up the rest, and drank the Coke. I gave a big burp and felt pretty decent. I took a shower and got dressed in a short denim skirt, white sneakers, and a white t-shirt. I pulled my hair into a ponytail, applied some lipstick and a single swipe of mascara, and I was ready for the day. I put a call into Lula and got her at a truck stop.
"I'm fine," she said. "Me and Boo are having breakfast. We're making real good time. We're traveling straight along Route 40 all the way. This here's real interesting. I never drove through anything like this before. This is cowboys and Indians country."
I hung up, dropped a raisin and a small chunk of cheese into Rex's cage, gave Bob a hug, and told everybody I'd be back. I locked up after myself and waved to Tank. Tank gave me a nod back. I drove the short distance to my parents' house and parked in the driveway. My grandmother was at the door waiting for me, responding to some mysterious instinct embedded in Berg women, an early warning signal that a daughter or granddaughter was approaching.
"That big guy is following you again," Grandma said, opening the door to me.
"Tank."
"Yeah, I wouldn't mind spending some time with him. You think he could go for an older woman?"
"Young women, old women, barnyard animals."
"Hard to say with Tank."
"Your mother's at the store and the girls are off playing somewhere," Grandma said. "Valerie's in the kitchen eating us out of house and home."
"How's she doing?"
"Looks like she's going to explode."
I went in and took a chair across from Valerie. She was picking at a bowl of macaroni and chicken salad, not showing much enthusiasm for it.
"What's up?" I asked.
"I don't know. I'm not hungry. I think I'm in a slump. My life is same old, same old."
"You're having a baby. That's pretty exciting."
Valerie looked down at her stomach.
"Yeah."
She gently rubbed the baby bulge.
"I'm excited about that. It's just that everything else is so unsettled. I'm living here with Mom and Dad and Graham. After the baby, there'll be four of us in that one small bedroom. I feel like I'm swallowed up and there's no more Valerie. I was always perfect. I was the epitome of well-being and mental health. Remember how I was serene, St. Valerie? And I adapted when I moved to California. I went from serene to perky. I was cute," Valerie said. "I was really cute. I made birthday cakes and pork tenderloins. I bought my jerk-off husband a grill. I had my teeth bleached."
"Your teeth look great, Val."
"I'm confused."
"About Albert?"
Valerie rested her elbow on the table and her chin in her hand.
"Do you think he's boring?"
"He's too funny to be boring. He's like a puppy, sort of floppy and goofy and wanting to be liked.
He could be a little annoying, but that's different from boring, right?"
"I feel like I need a hero. I feel like I need to be rescued."
"That's because you weigh 400 pounds and you can't get out of a chair by yourself. After you have the baby, you'll feel different."
Okay, so I was being a big fat hypocrite again. I felt the same way as Val. I wanted to be rescued too. I was tired of being brave and semi-competent. Difference was, I refused to say it aloud. I suspected it was a basic instinct, but it felt wrong somehow. For starters, it felt like a terrible burden to dump on a man.
"Do you think Albert is at all heroic?"
Valerie asked me.
He doesn't look like a hero, but he gave you a job when you needed one, and he stood by you. I guess that's sort of heroic. And I think he'd run into a burning building to save you. Whether he'd get her out of the building is another issue. Probably they'd both die a horrible death. I think you're doing the right thing by not getting married, Val. I like Albert, but you don't want to marry him just because Mom's in favor of it, or because you need a second income. You should be in love, and you should be sure he's the right man for you and the girls.
Sometimes it's hard to tell what's love and what's only indigestion, Valerie said.
I left Valerie with a macaroni salad and drove to the office. Connie looked around her computer screen at me when I walked in. Well, I asked, are you married?
No, it turned out to be a joke photo. I caught the 10 o'clock out of Vegas.
And the room damage?
It all went on Vinny's credit card. Vinny almost popped a vein when he heard. But then the reporters started showing up and Vinny was distracted. The room bill got pushed on a back burner. You saved Vinny's ass. You even made him look good. The visa bond worked. The guy fled. We found him.
Actually, the Vegas cops found Singh.
Not when Vinny tells it. Vinny's made some improvements on the story. So we all still have our jobs. Vinny's not going to be selling used cars in Scottsdale. Everybody's happy.
Everybody except me. I was being stalked by a lunatic, and it was possible that I was indirectly responsible for causing 3 murders.
Now that Singh is off the books, I got a backlog of skips,
Connie said.
What would you like? First-time rapist, repeat domestic violence, assault with a deadly weapon, or possession?
What's a possession?
Kilo of heroin.
Whoa, that's a biggie. That's Rangers. How about the deadly weapon?
Butchie Salazar and Ryan Mock got into a fight over Candace Laylor, and Butchie ran over Ryan with his Jeep Cherokee 3 times.
Butchie was drunk?
Yep.
Gimme Butchie. Sometimes a drunk is an easy catch if you can get him in the morning. I took the papers from Connie. I didn't need a photo. I knew Butchie. Went to school with him. Didn't like him back then. Wasn't real crazy about him now.
I'll give you the rapist, too. It's his first time around. Maybe he just forgot to show for court. I tried calling, but all I get is a machine.
Have you tried his work number?
He's unemployed. Got fired when he got arrested.
I looked around. It feels strange not to have Lula here.
Quiet,
Connie said. Empty.
Glorious,
Vinny yelled from his inner office.
Freakin' glorious.
I hefted my bag higher on my shoulder, and I headed out. Tank was standing guard on the sidewalk in front of my car. I have a couple FTAs, I said to Tank. One's in the Berg and one's in Hamilton Township. I have to stop at my apartment first to get some clean clothes and stuff.
It might be easier if we took one car for the busts, Tank said.
I agreed. Do you want to drive or ride shotgun? Tank's eyebrows raised a fraction of an inch. Shocked that I would even consider driving. Tank only rode shotgun to Ranger. It's the 21st century, I told Tank. Women drive.
Only in my bed, Tank said. Never in my car.
I didn't have a reply to that, but I thought it sounded like an okay philosophy. So I beeped the escape locked, got into Tank's SUV, and we chugged off for my place. We went through the standard routine at my apartment. Tank went in first and did a safety check. The photos were gone from the floor. Residue remained where the police had checked for prints. I gathered a few things together when Tank gave the all clear. Mostly what I wanted from my apartment was hardware. I took the cuffs and pepper spray from my bedside table and dropped them into my shoulder bag. I went to the cookie jar next and added the .38 to my bag of goodies. I knew Tank was fully armed and probably had 50 pairs of cuffs in the back of his truck, but I wanted my own. Am I a professional or what? I locked up and we took the elevator. 200-year-old Mrs. Bessler was in the elevator, joyriding.
Going down,
she told us, pressing the button, leaning on her walker.
First floor ladies' handbags, designer shoes.
She looked up at Tank.
My goodness, you're a big one, she said.
Tank smiled at her. Big Bad Wolf reassures Grandma he's not going to eat her for lunch. The doors opened, and we got out. "Have a nice day, Mrs. Bessler," I said.
"Don't take any wooden nickels," Mrs. Bessler sang out.
According to Butchie Salazar's bond agreement, he was renting the top half of a two-family house on Allen Street. For years now, Butchie's worked nights tending bar at a dive on Front Street, so chances were good that he'd be at home. Tank did a pass in front of the house. No activity. He returned and parked two houses down on the opposite side of the street. I called Butchie on my cell phone and got his machine. I didn't leave a message. Tank and I got out and approached the house. No back door to worry about, so we positioned ourselves to either side of the front door. I rang the bell for the upstairs apartment and waited. No response. I rang again. The downstairs door opened, and an older woman stuck her head out.
"Butchie isn't home, and my cats hate when people ring his bell," she said. "The bell scares my cats. They're very sensitive."
"Do you know where Butchie is?"
"It's his day off from work. I think he's gone out to do his grocery shopping and stuff. Not that he does a lot of cooking. Mostly he buys beer and filthy magazines. I tell you, this neighborhood's going to hell in a handbasket."
The woman closed her door, and I looked up at Tank. It was strange being on a bus with him. I was used to Lula with her crazy clothes and smart mouth. "Okay," I said. "Let's go for the rapist, Stephen Wiegand. We can come back to Butchie later." Wiegand lives in Hamilton Township in one of those apartment complexes off Clockner Boulevard. Minutes later, we were parked in the lot in front of Stephen Wiegand's apartment. We sat for a couple minutes getting the feel of things. A woman left her apartment two doors down, got into her car, and drove off. Aside from that, there was no activity. "One of us should take the back door," I said.
"Can't do that," Tank said. "My first job is to protect you, and I can't do that if I can't see you."
"No one followed us here. I was watching." Tank went stony, an unmovable object. "Fine," I said. "We'll both take the front door." We left the truck, crossed the lot, and I rang Wiegand's bell. Wiegand answered on the first ring. You've got to love first-time offenders. They don't know the drill. Next time around, Wiegand will be out the back door, hiding in the dumpster. He was a slim 5'8", with close-cut brown hair and dark brown eyes. His papers listed his age as 26. He was unmarried. "Yes," Wiegand said, looking first to me, then up at Tank. The gears were turning in Wiegand's head when he looked at Tank. Tank wasn't someone you wanted to unexpectedly find on your doorstep. "Stephen Wiegand?" I asked. Wiegand swallowed. "Uh-huh." I introduced myself and explained to Wiegand that he missed his court date and needed to refile. Wiegand bobbed his head yes, but his eyes were saying no, no, no. I reached back and took hold of the cuffs secured under my skirt waistband. Wiegand went white, turned, and bolted. And before I could make a move, Tank effortlessly grabbed Wiegand by the scruff of his neck and held him 2 inches off the floor. Wiegand kicked out and then went limp. Tank gave Wiegand a shake, causing Wiegand's feet to flop around.
"I'm going to put you down now," Tank said, "and you're not going to try anything stupid, right?"
"Right," Wiegand said. I cuffed Wiegand, we secured his apartment, and we all marched over to Tank's SUV. We put Wiegand in the back seat, cuffed and shackled. I couldn't help thinking it would have played out differently if Tank hadn't been along. Lula and I would have chased Wiegand all over his apartment, knocking over lamps and chairs in the process. We would have snagged him eventually, but the capture would have been total Abbott and Costello. "Do all your captures go like that?" I asked Tank.
"No," he said. "They don't always try to run."
It was mid-afternoon when we left the police station. Wiegand was back behind bars. Tomorrow morning he'd go before the judge, who would once again set bail, higher this time. Vinny would get a call from a pleading Wiegand, and for another bonding fee, Wiegand would walk. We stopped off at Cluck in a Bucket for a late lunch, and then motored over to the Berg to try our luck with Butchie. We parked across the street and looked up at Butchie's open windows.
Television sounds drifted out to us. Butchie was home. We crossed the street and took our places on the small stoop that served as a front porch.
"Do you know this guy?" Tank asked.
"Yeah."
"Is he going to shoot at us?"
"Depends how drunk he is." Tank drew his gun, and I rang the bell. No answer to the bell. I rang again. Still no answer.
"He's not coming down," Tank said.
I called Butchie on my cell phone.
"Yeah,"
Butchie said.
"It's Stephanie Plum," I told him.
"I'm downstairs with my partner, and we need to talk to you."
"So go ahead and talk."
"You missed your court date, and you need to reschedule."
"And?"
"And you need to do it now. Come downstairs and open the door."
"Suck my dick,"
Butchie said. "Sure," I told him. "Just come down and open the door."
"Fuck off,"
Butchie said.
"I don't feel like going to jail today. Why don't you come back next month? Maybe I'll feel like going to jail next month."
I told Tank to back up and stand on the sidewalk where Butchie could see him. "Look out your window, Butchie," I said. "See the big guy standing on the sidewalk?"
"Yeah."
"That's my partner. If you don't open the door, he's going to put his foot through it. And then he's going to go upstairs and root you out like the rodent you are and put his foot up your ass."
"I've got a gun."
"Is it as big as Tank's?" Tank was holding a .44 Magnum.
"I swear to God," Butchie said, "if you come in, I'll blow your head off."
And he disconnected. "He's not coming down," I told Tank. "And he says he's armed." Tank walked up to the door, put his boot to it just left of the handle, and the door flipped open.
"Wait here," Tank said.
I had my gun in hand, too. "No way. This is my bust." Tank turned and looked at me.
"Anything happens to you, I have to answer to Ranger. Frankly, I'd rather take a bullet from this moron."
"Okay, that made sense to me. I'll wait here," I told him.
"I'm coming up the stairs," Tank called to Butchie. "When I get to the top, I want you unarmed, face down on the floor, with your hands where I can see them."
I looked up and saw Butchie ass first, half out of the window above me. He was waiting for Tank to get to the top of the stairs, and then Butchie was going to go out of the window, onto the small roof over the stoop, and drop to the ground. I ducked into the doorway so Butchie wouldn't see me. I held my breath and waited to hear him on the roof. Tank got to the top of the stairs, Butchie's feet scuffed on the roof, and I jumped out. I had my gun two-handed, and I yelled for Butchie to stop and freeze.
"I've got him," I yelled to Tank. "He's on the porch roof."
Tank jogged down the stairs and moved to join me on the small patch of front lawn. He cleared the porch just as Butchie catapulted himself off the roof, and the two of them crashed to the ground with Butchie on top of Tank. I rushed in and grabbed Butchie by the arm, cuffing him behind his back while he still had the air knocked out of him. I rolled him off Tank and shoved him aside. Tank was on his back, with his leg twisted at an impossible angle.
"Just shoot me," Tank said. "It'd be less painful."
I called EMS, and then I called Ranger. A half hour later, Tank was rolled into the EMS truck, his leg held stable by an inflated cast. Ranger and I stood side by side and watched the truck disappear around the corner. A big, bald, jug-headed guy, neatly dressed in black jeans and t-shirt, stood by Tank's truck. He had his muscle-bound, bulging arms crossed over his massive chest and his tiny eyes fixed on Ranger and me.
"I need to go to the hospital and get Tank admitted," Ranger said. "I've asked Cal to follow you around."
"Cal has a flaming skull tattooed onto his forehead, and he has muscles in places muscles aren't supposed to grow. Cal looks like Steroidosaurus."
"Don't underestimate him," Ranger said. "He can spell his name. He's not overly violent, as long as he remembers to take his medication. And he gives good shade."
I did a grimace. Ranger pulled me to him and kissed me on the forehead.
"You two are going to get along just fine."
Ranger stepped back and turned to Butchie, who was sitting cuffed and shackled on the curb. He grabbed Butchie, dragged him to his feet, and handed him over to Steroidosaurus. It was almost 6 when we left the police station. Butchie was chained to a bench across from the docket lieutenant. Stephen Wiegand was in the lockup. I had body receipts for both of them. Not a bad day in terms of income. Not a great day in terms of Tank's leg. Definitely a weird day, having spent it in the company of Ranger's merry men. Halfway through town, my cell phone rang.
"Your sister's in labor," Grandma said. "She was working her way through a Virginia-baked ham when she started getting contractions.
Is she going to the hospital?"
"She's trying to decide if it's time. Do you think I should call Albert?"
"Definitely call Albert. It's his baby, too. He's been going to the birthing classes with Valerie."
"It's just that she's not in a good mood. You know how it is when she gets disturbed in the middle of a ham."
Valerie was sitting on the couch in the living room when I arrived. She was doing her breathing exercises and rubbing her stomach. My mother and grandmother were standing beside her, watching. The two girls were on the floor, staring bug-eyed at Valerie. My father was in his chair in front of the television, channel surfing. "So," I said, "what's up?" The front door crashed open behind me, and Albert stumbled in.
"Am I too late? Did I miss anything? What's going on?"
"Mommy's having a baby," Angie said.
Mary Alice nodded her head in agreement. Albert looked terrible. His shirt was untucked, and his eyes were glassy. His face was chalk white, with red spots high on his cheeks.
"You don't look so good," Grandma said to Albert. "How about a ham sandwich?"
"I've never had a baby before," Albert said. "I'm a little flubbadubbed."
"I'm having another contraction," Valerie said. "Is anyone timing? Aren't these coming awful close together?"
I didn't know anything about having a baby, but I knew it worked better if you delivered it in the hospital. "Maybe we should go to St. Francis," I said. "Do you have a suitcase ready?" Valerie went into the breathing and rubbing mode again, and my mom ran upstairs for the suitcase. "So what do you think, Valerie?" I asked when she stopped rubbing and puffing. "You've done this before. Are you ready to go to the hospital?"
"I was ready weeks ago," Valerie said. "Someone help me get up."
Albert and I each took an arm and pulled Valerie up. She looked down.
"I can't see my feet. Do I have shoes on?"
"Yep," I said. "Sneakers." She felt around.
"And I've got pants on, right?"
"Black stretchy shorts," stretched to within an inch of their lives. My mother came down the stairs with the overnight bag.
"Are you sure you don't want to get married?" she asked Valerie. "I could call Father Gabriel. He could meet you at the hospital. People get married in the hospital all the time."
"Contraction!"
Valerie said, huffing and puffing, holding Clown's hand in a death grip. Clown went down to one knee.
"Yow! You're breaking my hand!"
Valerie kept huffing.
"Okay," Clown said. "Okay, okay. It's not so bad now that the hand's gone numb. Besides, I got another one, right? And probably this one's not actually broken. It's just mashed. It'll be fine, right? Mashed isn't so bad. Mashed, squished, smushed. That's all okay. That's not, like, broken, right?"
The contraction passed, and we propelled Valerie out the door, down the sidewalk to the driveway. While the rest of us were flubbadubbed, my father had slipped outside and started the car. Sometimes my father knocks me out. On the surface, he's all meat and potatoes and television. But the truth is, he doesn't miss much. We put Valerie in the front seat. Albert, my mom, and I got in the back seat. Grandma and the girls stayed behind, waving. The trip was only several blocks long. St. Francis was walking distance from my parents' house, if you wanted to take a good long walk. I called Morelli from the car and told him I wouldn't be home for dinner. Morelli said that was cool since there didn't seem to be any dinner anyway. Even with our combined abilities, Morelli and I as a single entity didn't equal a bad housewife. Bob ate regularly because we scooped his food out of a big bag. After that, it was all downhill to takeout. Albert and I walked Valerie in through the emergency entrance, and my mom and dad took off to park the car. A nurse came forward.
"Oh, my God," she said. "Valerie Plum, I haven't seen you in years. It's Julie Singer." "I'm Julie Wisneski now."
Valerie blinked at her.
"You married Whiskey? I had a big crush on him when I was in high school."
This caught me by surprise.
I was just a couple years behind Valerie, but I had no idea she'd had a crush on Whiskey. Whiskey was drop-dead cute, but not a lot upstairs. If you talked cars with Whiskey, you were on solid ground. Any topic other than cars, forget about it. Last I heard, he was working in a garage in Ewing, probably happy as a clam at high tide.
"Big contraction,"
Valerie said, her face turning red, her hands on her belly. "So, what do you think?" I asked Julie. "I don't know a lot about this stuff, but she looks like she's going to have a baby, right?"
"Yeah,"
Julie said.
"Either that or 42 puppies. What have you been feeding her?"
"Everything." My mom and dad hustled in and went to Valerie.
"Julie Wisniewski," my mom said. "I didn't know you were working here."
2 years now," Julie said.
"I moved from Helene Fuld."
"How are the boys? And Whiskey?" my mom wanted to know. Big smile from Julie.
"Driving me nuts."
My dad was looking around. He didn't care about Whiskey and the boys. He was scoping out televisions and vending machines. Good to know where the essentials are in a new environment. Julie wedged Valerie into a wheelchair and took her away. My parents went with Valerie. Clown and I were left to complete the admission ritual. From the corner of my eye, I caught sight of a black hulking mass positioned against a wall. Steroidosaurus was still watching over me. When we satisfied admissions that the bill would be paid, I sent Albert upstairs to be with Valerie, and I went over to talk to Cal. "It's not necessary for you to stay," I said. "I'm going to be here for a while. When I'm done at the hospital, I'm going back to Morelli's house. I don't think I'm in any danger." Cal didn't move, didn't say anything. I slipped out the emergency room door and called Ranger and filled him in. "So I thought it didn't make sense for Cal to stay here all night while I'm with Valerie."
"Hospitals don't scream for killers," Ranger said. "Keep Cal with you."
"He's scaring people."
"Yeah," Ranger said. "He's good at that."
I disconnected, returned to the emergency room lobby, and went upstairs to look for Valerie. Cal followed close at my heels. We found Valerie on a gurney in a hospital gown under a sheet, her stomach a huge swollen mound on top of her. My mother and father were at her head. Albert was holding her hand. Julie was attaching an ID bracelet onto Valerie's wrist.
"Oh my God,"
Valerie said.
"Ugh!"
And her water broke. It was an explosion of water, a tidal wave. We're talking Hoover Dam quantity water. Water everywhere, but mostly on Cal. Cal had been standing at the bottom of the gurney. Cal was totally slimed from the top of his head to his knees. It dripped off the end of his nose and ran in rivulets down his bald head. Valerie drew her legs up, the sheet fell away, and Cal gaped at the sight in front of him. Julie stuck her head around for a look.
"Uh-oh," Julie said. "There's a foot sticking out. Guess this is going to be a breech baby."
That was when Cal fainted.
Crash!
Cal went over like he was a giant redwood cut down by Paul Bunyan. Windows rattled, and the building shook. Everyone clustered around Cal.
"Hey!"
Valerie yelled.
"I'm having a baby here!"
Julie went back to Valerie.
"Is it a girl or a boy?"
Valerie wanted to know.
"I don't know," Julie said, "but it's got big feet, and it's not a puppy."
A doctor appeared and took charge of Valerie, wheeling her down the hall. Clown and my mom followed after Val and the doctor. My father wandered into a room that had a ball game going, and I watched a couple nurses pop ammonia capsules under Cal's snout. Cal opened his eyes but didn't look like anyone was home.
"He hit his head pretty hard when he fell," one of the nurses said. "We should get him checked out."
Good thing it was his head, I thought. Not a big loss there if it's broken. It took 6 people to get Cal onto a stretcher, and then they rolled him away in the opposite direction they'd gone with Valerie. One of the nurses asked if I knew him. I said his name was Cal. That was about it. That was what I knew. I wasn't allowed to use my cell phone in that part of the hospital, so I went outside to call Ranger. "About Cal," I said. He's sort of out of commission.
Used to be you destroyed my cars, Ranger said.
Yeah, those were the good old days.
How bad is it?
Valerie's water sort of broke on him and he fainted. Bounced his head on the floor a couple times when he went down. Lucky he was in the hospital when it happened. He was looking a little dopey, so they took him somewhere for testing.
St. Francis?
Yep. Disconnect. I was making a shambles of the merry men. I suspected Tank was somewhere in the hospital, too. I'd stop in to say hello, but I only knew him as Tank. Probably Tank wasn't the name listed on the chart. Morelli called while I was still outside.
So?
I'm at the hospital with Valerie, I told him. It's been pretty uneventful except for the birth and the concussion.
What? No fires or explosions? No shootouts?
Like I said, it's been quiet, but it's still early.
I hate to ruin my tough guy image, but to tell you the truth, I don't even like to kid about this stuff anymore.
I didn't know how to tell him. I wasn't kidding. I should get back to Valerie, I said.
Television sucks tonight. Maybe I'll come over to the hospital.
That would be nice. The sky was overcast, and a fine mist was settling around me. Streetlights popped on in the gloom. A block away, headlights glowed golden on cars cruising Hamilton. I'd exited the emergency entrance on Burt Avenue to make the call. I'd walked toward the back of the building, going just far enough to avoid activity. I had my back pressed to the brick wall of the hospital while I talked, trying to stay dry, trying to keep my hair from frizzing. Used to be there were houses across the street, but several years ago the houses were torn down and a parking lot was created. A kid walked out of emergency and turned toward me, moving with his head down against the light rain, hugging a small gym bag to his chest. From the brief look I'd caught of his face, I'd put him somewhere in his late teens to early 20s. Not really a kid, I guess, but he dressed like a kid. Low-slung, baggy homeboy pants, gym shoes, short-sleeved shirt unbuttoned over a black t-shirt, spiky green hair. Probably had multiple piercings and tattoos, but I couldn't see any from this distance. I dropped my phone into my purse and headed back to emergency. The green-haired kid got a couple feet from me and staggered a little, bumping against me. He picked his head up, looked me in the eye, and raised a gun level with my nose.
"Turn and walk," he said. "I'm really good with this gun. I'll shoot you dead if you make a single false move."
Usually there were people hanging out around emergency, but the rain had driven everyone inside. The street was deserted, not even car traffic. "Is this about money?" I asked him. "Just take my bag."
"Huh, you wish, sweetie pie. This is the game, and I'm the winner. Just me and the webmaster left. I get to go on to the next game after I do you."
I turned and gaped at him.
"What?" he asked. "You didn't know it was me? You didn't think the hunter had green hair?"
"Who are you?" He jumped and slashed at the air.
"I'm the Fisher Cat."
I'd never heard of a Fisher Cat. I was pretty sure we didn't have any in Trenton. "Is that a real animal, or did you make it up?"
"It's a member of the weasel family. It moves along real quiet. You hardly know it's around. It's real sneaky, and it's ferocious."
"Have you ever seen one?"
"Well, no, not exactly. You know, like in a book."
"If I was going to name myself after an animal, I'd want to see it first."
"That's because you have no imagination. Gamers have imagination. We create stuff."
"What stuff?"
"The game, stupid. And then we transcend the game. The game becomes the reality. Is that total whack or what?"
"Yeah, total whack." It had been a long day with a lot of adrenaline expended. For that matter, it had been a long week that had brought a lot of terror and death. This kid was right about one thing. I hadn't expected the bearer of that terror and death to have green hair and a tongue stud. "So this is a game," I said. "With a webmaster?"
"Pretty cool, huh?"
"Did you pull the wings off butterflies when you were a kid?"
"No, I was a total wimp kid. I was a wimp until I found the webmaster and got into the game."
"Are there rules to the game, or do you just go around randomly killing people?"
"The webmaster runs the game. He's the one who decides who can play.
Not everyone gets to play, you know. There are always 5 players and a prize. This time, you're the prize. I know you've been getting messages from the webmaster. That's part of his job. He's the one who keeps the rabbit running while the players are in the elimination stage. This is my 2nd game. The 1st game was a couple years ago. I was last man standing on that one, too. I got to hunt a cop that time.
What's with the flowers?
That's the game designation. If you play the webmaster's game, you're a red roses and white carnations player.
I couldn't believe I was standing on the sidewalk talking to this kid who looked more like the Green Goblin than a fisher cat and was holding me at gunpoint, and not a car drove by. No one strolled through the emergency room doors looking for a place to sneak a smoke. No emergency vehicles barreled down the street with lights flashing. You look kind of young to be killing people, I said, as if age mattered when you were insane.
Yeah, so far as I know, I'm the youngest player. I was 17 when I killed Lillian Parisi. I got so excited I did the deed on her after she was dead.
That's sick and disgusting. Fisher Cat giggled.
Maybe I'll do it on you, too, after I blow your head apart. I should have done it on Sing. The webmaster sent me to Vegas to get Sing. Really nice of you to find the little jerk for us. You don't just walk out on a game. The game is everything.
I thought I was sounding pretty comfortable. My voice wasn't wobbling. My breathing appeared normal. I was asking questions. Deep inside, there was bone-jarring fear. This was a seriously sick person. He had a gun, and it was going to ruin his night if he didn't kill me.
The Fisher Cat has a real good sense of smell, he said. I can smell your fear.
I don't think that's fear you smell, I said. My sister's water broke on me.
Don't joke about it, he yelled. This is serious. This is the game.
Oh, boy. Good going, Stephanie. Now he's mad. He waved the gun at me.
Walk toward the garage.
I hesitated, and he shoved the gun in my face.
I swear to God, I'll kill you right here if you don't start walking, he said, still agitated.
So maybe it was fear he smelled. I was putting out a lot of it. I walked toward the garage, thinking the garage might be helpful. It looked empty, but visiting hours were still going on, and I knew there had to be people around. I'd never paid attention before, but there had to be security cameras. Whether they were working or anyone was watching was a whole other thing. We were still on the sidewalk, almost to the back of the garage. I assumed we were going in through the rear exit, and once we were inside, I would make my move. My plan was to jump behind a car and then run like the wind, screaming my lungs out. Not real sophisticated, but it was all I had.
Stop here, he said. This is my truck.
It was a dark blue pickup parked at the curb. The paint was faded, and there was rust showing around the tailpipe. The bed was covered with an old white fiberglass cap. So much for escape plan A.
Get in the back, Fisher Cat said. We're going for a ride.
No way was I getting into the truck. The gun was scary. The truck was death. I rolled out and jerked away from him. He fired off a shot, and I felt the bullet bite into my arm. I turned and ran, and he ran after me, snagging the back of my shirt, throwing me off balance. I went down to one knee, pulling him down with me, and the gun dropped out of his hand. And that's when I snapped. I was suddenly really pissed off. I whacked him with my purse, a good solid whoomp on the side of his head that jarred his mouth open and had his vision unfocused. I probably should have hit him with my bag again, but I wanted to get my hands on him. I wanted to gouge his stupid eyes out. This little creep killed people for a game, and one of them was a cop. My sister was in the hospital having a baby, and this jerk-off was trying to kill me. How tacky is that? I grabbed him by his ridiculous green hair and banged his head into the truck a couple times. He was flailing out with his arms, kicking at my legs. We both went down to the ground and rolled around, locked together like a couple squirrels, scratching and clawing and hissing. We weren't bitch-slapping, trying to make a statement like Lula and Mrs. Apicenja. This was real life-or-death combat.
Luckily, while we were rolling around, my knee connected with Fisher Cat's crotch, and I shoved his gonads halfway up his throat. Fisher Cat went dead still, and almost in slow motion, somebody's fist smashed Fisher Cat's nose. Looking back on it, I suppose it was my fist. At the time, the fist didn't seem to be connected to my brain. The nose gave with a sickening crunch, and blood spurted out, killing my outrage.
"Oh, crap," I said. "I'm really sorry."
I don't know why I said it, because I wasn't all that sorry. It was one of those female reflex things. His right hand blindly struck out at me. He made contact with my arm, and lights exploded behind my eyes. When I came around, I was on my back on the sidewalk. The misting rain felt good on my face. It was dark, but there were lights everywhere, red and blue and white. The lights were haloed in the rain, giving them a surreal quality. The fog cleared from my head. I blinked, and Ranger and Morelli swam into my field of vision. There were a lot of other people behind them. A lot of noise. Cops. Yellow crime scene tape, slick with rain.
"What happened?" I asked.
"It looks like you took a few volts," Morelli said.
His lips were tight, and his eyes were hard. It took a beat for me to remember. Fisher Cat's arm reaching out to me.
"Stun gun," I said. "I didn't see it until it was too late."
Morelli and Ranger each got a hand under an armpit and hauled me up to my feet. The first thing I saw was Fisher Cat, motionless on the grass beside his truck. A couple cops were in the process of setting lights to illuminate the body.
"Holy cow," I said. "He looks dead."
I had a moment of panic that I'd killed him. Now that he'd zapped me, it was sort of satisfying to know I'd broken his nose, but I wasn't crazy about the idea that I might have beat him to death. I looked closer and saw the two bullet holes in his forehead. I let out a whoosh of relief. I was almost certain I didn't shoot him. "Those aren't my bullet holes, are they?" I asked Morelli.
"No. We checked your gun. It hasn't been fired."
Ranger was grinning.
"Somebody beat the shit out of this guy before he got shot."
"That would be me," I said.
"Babe," Ranger said, the grin widening.
My arm felt like it was on fire. The entire upper half was wrapped in gauze, and a fine line of blood had begun to seep through the gauze.
"I'm missing a chunk of time," I said. "What happened after I went lights out?"
"Ranger and I pulled in minutes apart, and we got worried when we couldn't find you," Morelli said. "We knew you went outside to make some calls, so we went looking for you."
"And you found me laying here unconscious, and the green-haired guy dead?"
"Yeah."
Again, the tight lips and flat voice. Morelli didn't like finding me unconscious. Morelli loved me. Ranger loved me, too, but Ranger was programmed differently.
"Your turn," Morelli said.
I told them everything I knew. I told them about the game, about Fisher Cat, about the webmaster, about the cop.
"We need to do this downtown," Morelli said. "We need to get this recorded."
It was raining harder. My hair was soaked. The bandage on my arm was soaked. I was streaked with mud and blood. My legs and arms were scratched from the scuffle.
"How's Valerie?" I asked. "Is she okay? Did she have the baby?"
"I don't know," Morelli said. "We haven't checked on her."
The ME angled his truck into the curb just in front of the blue pickup. He got out and walked toward the body. He looked over and nodded to Morelli.
"I need to talk to him," Morelli said. "And you need to go inside and get your arm looked at. It's not serious. The bullet just grazed you, but it probably needs stitches."
He looked over at Ranger.
"If anyone in her family sees her like this, they'll freak."
"No sweat," Ranger said. "I'll get her cleaned up before I get her stitched up."
Ranger loaded me into his truck and drove me to Morelli's house. He opened the front door, switched a light on, and Bob came running. Bob stopped when he saw Ranger and eyed him suspiciously.
"I can see this dog's a killer," Ranger said.
Ferocious, I told him.
I'm assuming you have clothes here, Ranger said. Do you need any help?
I can manage. His eyes darkened.
I'm good in the shower.
My temperature went up a couple notches. I know. If I need help, I'll yell for you. Our eyes held. We both knew I'd jump out the bathroom window if I heard Ranger on the stairs. I took a boiling hot shower, scrubbing away the dirt and blood and horror, being careful not to soak my slashed arm any more than was necessary. I toweled off and gasped when I looked in the mirror and saw my hair. A huge chunk of hair was missing. The left side was 4 inches shorter than the right side. How the hell did that happen? It had to have been Fisher Cat. Okay, that does it. I was glad I broke his nose. To tell you the truth, I wasn't sorry he was dead, either. I got dressed in clean jeans, t-shirt, and sneakers. I tucked my wet hair behind my ears, covered it with a ball cap I found in Morelli's closet, and went downstairs. Ranger was slouched on the couch, watching a ball game. Bob was beside him, his big, shaggy orange Bob head resting on Ranger's leg. "Looks like male bonding going on here," I said. Ranger stood and clicked the television off.
"Dogs love me."
He slid an arm around my shoulders and herded me to the front door.
"I called the hospital. Valerie had a baby girl. They're both doing great."
Happiness and relief rushed from the center of my chest, clear to my fingertips, and there was a terrifying moment when I was afraid I was going to cry in front of Ranger. I ordered myself to get a grip, and I steadied my voice. "What about Cal and Tank?" I asked.
"They've both been discharged. Tank's got his leg in a cast. Cal has a concussion. Not serious enough to keep him in the hospital."
Ranger drove me to the hospital and walked me into the emergency room. He waited while my arm was cleaned and stitched. Then he called Morelli.
"She's done," Ranger said. "Does she want to take over?"
Morelli arrived a couple minutes later, and Ranger disappeared into the night. Someday when I had more time and emotional energy, I was going to have to think about the odd dynamic that existed between Morelli and Ranger and me. Morelli and Ranger were able to work as a team when necessary, all hostility seemingly put aside. And at the same time, in an entirely different area of the brain, rivalry existed. Morelli and I found our way to maternity and located Valerie. My parents were gone, but Clown was still there, sitting on the edge of a chair at bedside. "Sorry I missed the big event," I said to Valerie. "I had a mishap with my arm here."
"She was great," Clown said. "She was amazing. I don't know how she did it. I've never seen anything like it. I don't know how she got that baby out of there. It was magic."
Clown's face was still flushed, and his surgical gown was sweat-stained. He looked dazed and a little disbelieving.
"I'm a father," he said. "I'm a father."
His eyes filled, and his smile wobbled. He swiped at his eyes and his nose.
"I think I'm still flubbadubbed," he said.
Valerie smiled at Clown.
"My hero," she said.
"I was good, wasn't I? I helped you, right?"
"You were very good," Valerie told him.
The baby was in the room with Valerie. She was wrapped in a blanket, and she had a little knit cap on her head. She seemed impossibly small, and at the same time, too large to have exited through a vagina. When I was in school, I'd taken all the usual courses in human reproduction, and I knew the process: the uterine dilation, the flexibility of the pelvic bones, the muscle contractions. So I knew some of the biology, but it still looked to me like this was a case of threading a walrus through the eye of a needle. There were days when I wasn't sure how Morelli fit. I didn't want to contemplate trying to pass a baby.
"We've named her Lisa," Valerie said.
"Was it hard to pick out a name?" I asked.
"No,"
Valerie said.
"We both agreed on Lisa. It's the family name that's giving us problems."
Valerie looked tired, so I gave her a hug and a kiss. And then I gave Clown a hug and a kiss. And then we left. I'm not a huggy-kissy person, But this was a huggy-kissy occasion. Morelli and I left the hospital and went straight to Pino's. We ordered takeout, and 10 minutes later we walked into Morelli's house carrying a six-pack of Corona and a bag full of meatball subs. Bob was real happy to see us. Bob can smell a sub a quarter mile away. I dragged myself into the living room, flopped onto the couch, opened the sub bag, and handed them out. One for me, one for Morelli, and two for Bob. Morelli cracked open two beers. We each took a long pull and dug into the subs. Morelli channel-surfed while he ate, finally settling on wrestling.
"I'm tired," Morelli said. "You scare the hell out of me, and it makes me tired."
I was way beyond tired. I was numb. I had a lot of questions for Morelli, but I didn't want the answers tonight. I wasn't up to thinking. I could barely chew and swallow. Tomorrow morning I had to go to the station and tell a recording machine everything I knew about Fisher Cat and the game. Tomorrow would be a big questions and answers day. Hopefully when I woke up, my brain would be back in thinking mode. Good thing wrestling was on. You don't need a brain to enjoy wrestling. Lance Storm was kicking the bejesus out of some new guy who looked like King Kong's mutant brother. Storm was wearing little bright red panties that made him easy to find in my befuddled state. I opened a second beer and silently toasted Storm's panties. Chapter 13. Morelli nudged me awake.
"Rise and shine," he said. "I need to get to work, and you need to come with me."
"There's something poking me in my back." He slid his arms around me.
"Actually, we have a couple minutes to spare."
"How many minutes?"
"Enough to get the job done."
"Are we talking about your job or mine?" His hand skimmed the length of my belly and settled between my legs.
"We're wasting valuable time."
"Okay, here's the real difference between men and women. I wake up thinking about coffee and donuts, and Morelli wakes up thinking about sex." Morelli kissed the back of my neck, did some really clever things with his fingers down there, and the thoughts of coffee drifted away. Truth is, the magic fingers had my full attention, and the coffee thoughts were replaced by a fear that the fingers might stop. The fear was groundless, of course. Morelli had learned a lot since our first time behind the eclair case in the Tasty Pastry Bakery.
"So," Morelli said when we were done, "do you want to be first in the shower?"
I was face down on the bed. My heart rate was around 12 beats per minute, and I was in a state of euphoric, slobbering contentment. In fact, I think I might have been purring.
"You go first," I said. "Take your time."
Morelli went downstairs and got the coffee going before taking his turn in the bathroom. After a couple minutes, the coffee fumes penetrated my after-sex glow. I rolled out of bed, pulled on a pair of shorts and a t-shirt, and followed the fumes to the kitchen. I poured out a mug of coffee and padded to the front door to get the morning paper. I opened the door and found a red rose and a white carnation wrapped in cellophane sitting on the paper. So much for euphoria. I brought everything inside and locked the door behind me. I left the flowers on the sideboard and opened the small square white envelope that had accompanied the flowers. The envelope held a note written on cardstock. "Are you pleased that I saved you for myself? Do you get hot when you think about me and all I've done for you? I could have killed you last night, just as I could have killed you when I took you down with the dart, but that would have been too easy. Your death must be worthy of a hunter." It was signed, "Lovingly Yours," and tucked into the envelope